This episode begins with allegations from the United Nations about sexual violence against Israeli women on October 7th, 2023. You can skip to the 1 minute 20 timestamp, but periodically we also return to the topic of violence against women, so this episode may not be for everyone.
We also found that there are reasonable grounds to believe that conflict-related sexual violence, including rape and gang rape, occurred during the 7th of October attacks in at least three locations, namely the Nova Music Festival site and its surroundings, Road 232, and Kibbutz Reim. And in most of these incidents, victims were first subjected to rape and then killed, and at least two incidents relate to the rape of women's corpses. With regard to the hostages taken to Gaza, we found clear and convincing information that sexual violence, including rape, sexualized torture, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, has been committed against captives. And we also have reasonable grounds to believe that such violence may still be ongoing against those still held in captivity. I pause and must add that I am of the strong opinion that this finding does not in any way legitimize further violence, but actually reinforces the need for an urgent ceasefire.
That was Pramila Patton, the United Nations Special Representative on Sexual Violence in Conflict, discussing an international investigation of October 7th, 2023, when Hamas terrorists stormed over Israel's border and triggered the current and devastating war in Gaza. The most damaging attack since the 1948 war, more Israelis were killed in a single event than at any time since the Holocaust. Hamas fighters killed 695 civilians, 36 of whom were children, 71 foreign nationals, and 373 members of the Israeli Defense Forces. The attackers took around 250 hostages, which included at least 30 children, and several dozen contract workers from countries other than Israel. Thousands were wounded. Within a week, Israel initiated a terrifyingly violent attack designed to destroy Hamas, a military force embedded in a civilian population. By October 13th, experts predicted the humanitarian catastrophe that has since unfolded. By the end of January 2024, the civilian infrastructure, layered on top of thousands of miles of Hamas military tunnels, was between 50 and 60% damaged or destroyed. Hamas claims that over 30,000 Palestinians, the majority of them non-combatants, have been killed. As I record this podcast, Israeli forces are planning to move over 1 million sick, injured, and starving Palestinian refugees out of Rafah in southern Gaza to pursue the elimination of Hamas there as well. I want to note that while we all deplore unbridled violence, Israel's strategy is not unique, and it is frequently used in places where insurgent fighters are not fully embedded in urban infrastructure. Carpet bombing civilians was invented in World War II, and the United States destroyed two Japanese cities with nuclear weapons, causing generational suffering. So-called surgical strikes were used by the U.S. in both Iraq wars, bombing designed to deny the state access to water and power, and which killed civilians immediately and over time. Russian dictator Vladimir Putin pursued the strategy of destroying entire cities, along with cultural centers, hospitals, and schools in Chechnya. In Ukraine, Russian missiles continue to pound civilians and civilian infrastructure far from the front. Bashar al-Assad, the authoritarian president of Syria, also used these tactics against political dissenters in his own country, forcing states or insurrectionist forces to capitulate by killing, starving, torturing, and sexually assaulting civilians is not historically new or uncommon. That said, accusations of rape, sexualized murders, and genital mutilation of women and children on October 7th have proven particularly and unexpectedly controversial. Despite eyewitness testimony and visual evidence, Hamas has denied these attacks, while some pro-Palestinian journalists in the United States have gone to great lengths to sow doubt about sexual violence and to deny that it was part of the repertoire of terror that day. Denialism and doubt serve an important propaganda role, to be sure. But 50 years of feminist scholarship also demonstrates that war does not occur without sexual assault, just as it cannot be prosecuted without civilian casualties. The idea that you can have war without rape on all sides is historically implausible. And yet, to understand how war works, acknowledging and investigating these crimes is not where our conversation about gender and war can end. How men, women, and children experience violent conflict inspires, sustains, and promotes war. Women are not just the passive victims of violence. They are the ones who give birth to soldiers, become soldiers, support military operations, and care for the wounded, often for life. Men are raped. Palestinian mothers and fathers, like women in conflict zones everywhere, currently care for and feed families in reduced, terrifying, and exposed circumstances. Women are counted upon by military authorities to do the work left behind by men who fight, and to do public grieving that supports the continued recruitment of soldiers and the reproduction of patriotism. Women make the visible sacrifices that prop up masculine aggression and nationalist conflict. For me, one of the most powerful feminist thinkers about violence in international relations is Cynthia Enloe, a political scientist and feminist theorist at Clark University. An award-winning scholar, she is the author of 15 books that analyze militarism, war, and colonialism through the lens of feminist theory. And when the Middle East exploded on October 7th, I reached for her most recent volume, 12 Feminist Lessons of War. Each lesson is easily converted into a question that the reader could ask about any conflict, anywhere, at any moment in history. And as Enloe emphasizes, these questions lead us back to the same place. We are all complicit in the social militarization that sustains war. Join Cynthia and me for this episode of Why Now, where history and politics meet the challenge of today. And I'm your host, Claire Potter, Professor of History Emeritus at the New School for Social Research, a contributing editor at Public Seminar, and the author of the Political Junkie Substack. This is episode 49, Without Mothers, There Is No War. Cynthia Enloe, welcome to the show.
It's lovely to be here, Claire.
So, Cynthia, I am holding in my hand 12 Feminist Lessons of War from the University of California Press. This seems like the culmination of a career's worth of thinking about feminism and violence. And I wonder if you could just tell our listeners the story this book tells.
Yes, this is indeed, as you say, Claire, building on so many lessons I've learned from other people. I mean, in some ways, this is a very long thank you to so many feminists around the world, in Serbia and Japan and Cambodia and many countries, who have taught me what to watch, how to ask questions, how to dig, how to make links between things that don't look related. And in that sense, it is, it's an odd thing. It may feel to some people who've been following my stuff for a while, but it's also an opening. For a lot of people, this is the first book they are likely to have ever read about feminism, not just women, but feminism and a range of wars. It's also, I think, probably for a lot of people, the first book, maybe they've read an op-ed, but a first book that they've read about militarism, because this is an exploration of women's and men's relationships to militarization before wars and long after wars. So that violence is bred by militarization, but militarization can happen before any violence occurs. And for a lot of people, I think thinking about militarism and how they themselves might be imbibing militarism without realizing it, this might be quite a opening for them to think about their own complicity. I certainly think about my own complicity. This isn't about you, you, you. This is about us, us, us.
And it's very complicated because when a society is infected by militarism, there are many things we do and say and think about that seem relatively ordinary and not about war and not about violence. But if you pull a thread, it kind of unravels and they are. Can you give us an example of that?
One of my current favorites to think about and watch and wonder about. I don't have the answers to everything. I keep finding new things to wonder about. And that's camo, the wearing of tank tops and convoy pants. And there are all kinds of things in camo. There are even camo condoms now. And I think about that. And I wonder, what does somebody think when they put on a camo tank top on a hot day? Or what do they think they're doing when they choose a camo L.L. Bean knapsack to put on their back? What do they think? What do they think they're doing? Do they think camo is just a fashion and therefore empty of meaning? Though no fashion is empty of meaning. But is that what they imagine? Or do they think that camo is just hip? And if they think camo is hip, what do they mean by hip? And it doesn't mean that everyone who puts on a camo tank top or a camo knapsack is fully militarized. But I always think, well, there's grease on the slide towards militarization. And that's part of the grease.
It seems to me what you're saying here, and correct me if I'm wrong, is we may not have the answers to militarization. You say early on in the book, to be useful, a concept like militarization needs to be constantly tested against the messy realities it is intended to clarify. Part of what you seem to be saying is if we don't have all the answers, we can at least ask the right questions.
And keep asking them and track things. That I think over the years, one of the things I've learned is we should be good trackers. That is not just watch something in an episodic moment, but watch it over time. How does it evolve? How does it get reversed? How does somebody who bought a tank top that was camo in the 1990s decide, I'm not even going to give that to Goodwill. I'm going to throw that away. I'm not that person anymore. Or I'm not that person because now I think about something that I thought was just empty fashion. So tracking things over time, especially ideas and how ideas play out and whether concepts are useful, are they too cartoonizing or do they clarify? I think about that a lot. You have to have a long attention span.
You talk about women all the time, women as victims of violence, women sometimes as perpetrators of violence, women as collaborators in violence, and also women who are responsible for cleaning up the messes that war makes. I think all of these roles are really important. But let's start with women who participate in war. How have women participated in war over the last century?
Well, most governments, I think, Claire, can't wage a war without support of women. And they usually, government officials who are pro-war, not all government officials are, by the way, but those government officials who are keen to wage a war need women, especially as mothers, but also as wives, and oftentimes as workers, think of Rosie the Riveter, as girlfriends who will support their boyfriends enlisting or being conscripted without fleeing. Governments need women. So governments and militarizers in religious or secular or nationalist organizations, they know that you have to get women on board. Imagine this. If every woman who was, amongst other things, a mother, that's not the only thing every feminist knows, but let's say every woman who is at least in part of her life is a mother, was explicitly anti-militarist. You could not wage a war if you were a highly motivated militarizer. You couldn't. And governments know that. And so they play upon women's support of their children, especially their sons. They play on women as gaining the public status as a patriot, capital P, when women oftentimes feel as though they're only in domestic roles, and governments will urge them, say, no, this is your chance to be a civic hero, that is, a patriot. And for a lot of women, that's a chance that they don't want to miss. They are very worried about wives. Every government I've ever looked at, the men in those governments, and sometimes the women, but especially men in those governments, are very worried that women in their roles as wives will be anti-war, or at least be opposed to their husbands joining the war effort. And governments worry about that. Governments worry about women, but they don't admit it. Because if they admitted how worried they were about women as wives and women as mothers, in fact, they'd realize that they were admitting that women had power. So they don't voice their anxieties in public very much, but they act on them.
One of the things we see over time is also a concern about the men who return from war, wounded, maimed, traumatized, and that all of those things can sort of contribute to demasculinization. So you actually need these men to be met by women who will reassure them that they remain men, even if they're missing body parts, even if they're disabled for life, and so on.
Yes, and it's one of the reasons why in this 12 Feminist Lessons of War, I thought one of the lessons, because I had to figure out what, you know, there are probably 85 lessons, right? But, right. You know, that nobody's going to read a book of 85 lessons. 12 seemed like more than enough for anybody to digest. But I thought, well, one lesson I think I have to spell out is that post-war lasts a long time. And feminists know that post-war lasts a long time. Because when other people declare any war over, the Iran-Iraq war supposedly ended in 8 years, but it didn't. The U.S. war in World War I or Britain's war in the Crimea, they all lasted far beyond when the guns were officially silenced. And feminists have learned, a lot of feminist historians especially, have learned that you have to keep paying attention. You can't go on to the new, bright, shiny new news item. You have to say, I wonder what is happening, just the way you've said it. I wonder what's happening in Sri Lanka when the Tamil or Sinhalese men come home from that 25-year brutal war. What happens? What happens?
And you say in the book, and I'm going to quote you here, it has taken time for feminists in most countries to devote serious attention to those women who have joined militaries. Let's talk about the other role that women have increasingly played, certainly in this country, starting in the 1970s, of being actively recruited into the military. And before the 1970s, women served in auxiliary roles. We had the Women's Army Corps in World War II. There were sort of small numbers of women who did jobs in the military. But once we get to the all-volunteer military, there's an active effort to recruit women which then expands into a fight for women to have full combat roles so that they can have full access to promotions. On the one hand, that kind of equity seems feminist. And yet, let's look at it a little more carefully. What does it mean when women say, all right, we'll actually participate in the killing and the violence?
Well, yes, you're quite right that women have served in militaries around the world, but episodically. That is because the men who have a stake in continuing the masculinization of the military, and they have a stake in it because if the military, for even a bit of time, seems less the place to earn your badge of manliness, they won't get the male recruits they need. So military recruiters need the military to remain a bastion of masculinity because they need it for recruitment. But that's why women were dismissed, demobilized from militaries at the end of each war. Those countries that have ended all male conscription, what the Americans call the draft, those are the countries whose governments need women more than ever because they need to make up for the men that no longer are forced to enlist.
And of course, they also need questions of gender to be very clear. Women need to remain feminine, even if they're going to be in combat. Let's listen to this soldier in the 10th Mountain Division at Fort Drum talking about how being in the military and deploying to a combat zone in Iraq fits with her sense of herself as a feminine person.
Private Jeanette Vasquez from Albuquerque, New Mexico, says she has felt a drive to protect others all her life. Ready to fight for her country, she's eager to take her place on the field.
Just knowing that I could help people, risk my life for other people, it makes me feel better. I get to know that the people are safe, and that's all that matters to me. This is like a dream, you know? This is my passion.
The ladies in Company C-132 say being a woman never stopped them from pursuing their dreams.
That was broadcast on International Women's Day in 2020 on the Today Show, which is in many ways a women's show. And these young women were being portrayed as people who wanted to help others, who were following their passion, these sort of stereotypical female tropes. But these are women who are actually going into combat roles in an occupied Iraq. So how does the role of women in the U.S. military change after the Vietnam War, Cynthia?
So the time to think about in the United States is 1973, because that was, as you can remember, the middle of the U.S. war in Vietnam. It was at the peak of the U.S. popular anti-war movement, and it managed to persuade the mostly male members of Congress to believe that military service, when it's compulsory, was so distasteful to so many middle-class families that they really should rethink military forced conscription, compulsory conscription. And so it was 1973, not just any old date, not 1953, not 1983, 1973, that Congress ended the U.S. male compulsory service. But as they were debating, we have all the records of this. And by the way, African-American military sociologists have been feeling about how this came about. In the middle of debating about whether they should end the all-male draft in order to win back the support of the mainly white middle-class American voters, because what they didn't consider is shrinking the U.S. military. The U.S. Congress is militarized enough that they didn't want to shrink the size of the U.S. military. So they wanted to keep a very large U.S. military, and yet they would have to make up for all the men who now wouldn't be compelled to serve. So the question was, there you are in the subcommittee rooms of the U.S. Congress. How are we going to make them up? How are we going to make up all those numbers? And the debate was, according to African-American military sociologists that I've been tutored by, well, more men from poorer or with less job opportunity demographics. They will continue to voluntarily enlist. So the debate was, well, which is harder, if you will, to digest, all in quotes, in their white male minds? A higher proportion of Black and Latino men in the U.S. military, or more women of all races in the U.S. military? And they decided, because 1973 is also the early but very exciting days of the U.S. revived women's movement. And so they decided they could handle more women more easily than they could handle more men of color. It wasn't said quite so explicitly, but that's pretty much how the debate came down. And so that's the point at which the very reluctant Pentagon officials began deliberately recruiting more young women of all races. And in fact, a lot of African-American women voluntarily enlisted, not just white and Latino women.
Because the military in the United States and in some other countries is, of course, this huge engine of upward mobility. People can get educations, they can get job training, but at the cost of becoming part of the U.S. military machine and everything that that implies.
But I think the U.S. popular culture is so militarized that most people didn't find that problematic. Killing, yes. The military as an institution to get you out of your small rural town, to give you, although it's inflated in fact, some serious job training, to get you education benefits. That is what was sold, not the carrying an M16 rifle into some other people's country. And right. For a lot of people, and a lot of young women, I mean, I remember when I was first writing about this a long time ago, and I wrote it at a favorite cafe of mine called Modern Times here in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And this woman who was a low-paid waitress there, Helen, she would come over and say, "What are you writing, Cynthia?" And I'd tell her what I was writing. She'd say, "Oh, well, this is one of my favorite stories." I mean, it's true. And Helen, it was a slow day in the Modern Times, way after lunch, and I was scribbling away. And I said, "Helen, sit down, tell me." She said, "Well, in my Catholic high school, amongst us girls who are about to graduate, we debated which was the best way to put off marriage. Was it to join the military, or was it to become a nun?" She said, "I became a nun, but a lot of my friends went into the military. For both of them, it was a way to convince your parents that you were joining a respectable women-led organization," because at that point it was the WACS.
That's interesting. So you sort of choose one form of patriarchy over the other, and one that maybe you might have a little more agency in, or at least believe that you have more agency in.
Or it would just get you out of town.
Yeah. Just get out of town, which of course middle and upper class people do by going to college. So, Cynthia, you talk about some ways that war affects women that we don't normally attend to, things that are sometimes ancillary to the battlefield, sometimes things that are way off the battlefield and out of our sight. Could you talk about one or two of those things a little bit?
Well, you know, when I first started thinking about these 12 feminist lessons, I thought, well, one of the things that I'm a political scientist, which means there are a lot of things I've never been trained to think about. That's the bad news. But the good news, I've become a feminist, which means other feminists tell me I have to think about these things that my political science professors never told me I had to think about, which includes marriage. And because my feminist friends have said, you always have to think about marriage. You always have to think about sexuality. You always have to think about unpaid labor. If you want to be a feminist analyst explaining anything, the garment industry, the healthcare crisis, or war, if you want to think about anything, you better get up to speed in thinking like a feminist about marriage, about sexuality, about reproductive health, and about unpaid labor. And so by now, I've been well tutored over a number of years by non-political science feminists. And I began thinking at the very start of this book, what if you really gave the politics of women's relationships to marriage serious thought in order to understand women's experiences of any war? What if you began to give serious thought to the status of women without paid labor before you started to try and understand a war? Then what would be your understanding of war? And I began thinking that at just before the shots are fired, if you will, what is women's access to paid labor? What's women's status in law around custody of children? What are women's rights or lack of rights in the country that you're interested in? Ethiopia, Ukraine, US, whatever country. Their status within marriage, grounds for divorce, rights for physical integrity. What are their rights as a married woman? And I began kind of laying that out for myself and realizing, oh, good grief, a woman goes into a war really in such a different status than do men. And I'm not even saying a bad marriage. I'm saying a good marriage. A man's relationship to marriage and a woman's relationship to marriage are so different. And that's going to affect how they cope with a war. And that really was a wake-up call to me to think I had to think about childcare, marriage, sexuality, and paid or unpaid labor in order to understand women's and men's different experiences and resources for war.
Yeah. And of course, one difference is that women are sexually assaulted, sometimes in the armed services that they are fighting with, sometimes as civilians, sometimes as people who are in an area that's being invaded. And we know men are sexually assaulted as well, which is worth acknowledging. But the sexual assault of women is now a well-documented tool of war. I mean, we now know that that is an integral aspect of what happens when you send people to war. Right now, Cynthia, we are all spectators to a horrible conflict that has unfolded in Gaza. It was begun on October 7th, and one of the stories that filtered back to us about the invasion of Israel by Hamas was that women were raped. And there's been a lot of controversy about that on the American left, a lot of people saying this is just propaganda. I must confess that was not my response. My response from reading you and other feminists was, well, of course there was rape. But how do we think about rape in a situation where we still don't have the information we need to speak authoritatively about this conflict?
Well, I think what we've learned, Claire, is we should always ask, not presume that we know the answer. I never presume I know the answer, but always ask, where is sexual violence against women by men in any armed conflict? You don't know the answer, but you should ask the question, and you should ask it on all sides. And most wars have many sides, by the way. They don't just have two. And one should always ask it of every side in a war. And the question to be seriously, sensitively, carefully, rigorously investigated. So that means you don't just turn it into some, you know, banner of patriotism. You don't militarize the question. That's really hard to do, but you do not militarize the question or the investigation. You ask, where is men's sexual violence against particular women, which women, in any armed conflict. And one of the things that has been important is that we now have people who are trained to ask women who do not want to tell their story in a trust-building, caregiving way, so that women who do not trust most askers, do not trust most questioners, will feel enough trust that they will tell their story as completely as they can. It is an enormous risk in most of our societies, including the American society. It is a huge risk for any woman or girl to tell about a rape that has happened to her. So it's always undercounted everywhere. But it's also true that not all armed conflicts all the time make rape as an assault prominent. There's a wonderful researcher named Elizabeth Wood at Yale, and she has made effort to try and note which wars do not seem to have men's sexual assaults of women as a prominent feature, because then that makes us more curious about which wars have made it a prominent feature. But it's also true that because of the long patriarchal history of men's presumption of possessing women as property, that men on one side of a war will claim that their, always in quotes, that their women have been dishonored by the other men. And because that's a long patriarchal war-making, revenge-seeking narrative, we all have to be very careful. What we are learning in numbers of armed conflicts, I've just read a long study of what's just been happening to Ethiopian women in the Ethiopian 2020-2021 war, and it's horrific, is that you have to have trained, careful, medically equipped, trusted investigators.
One of the things that I find fascinating about your book is that the range of harms attached to war that you highlight are really not harms that can be prevented unless we decide we're not going to have wars. Isn't that right?
Well, I think we undercount the cost of war. I mean, one of the sources that many of your listeners might want to go to is called the Cost of War Project at Brown University. You can just go on the web and find it. And the wonderful people, including feminists who have created that Cost of War Project, have constantly said how hard it is to actually tally up, if you will, the true, genuine, long-term cost of war. And this is certainly true in women's lives. Once the firing overtly has been stopped, once something that at least states and international agencies call a ceasefire or a end of war has been declared, most people stop watching women because they don't need women anymore. Well, they do need them. They need them as unpaid caregivers of the traumatized men and the traumatized women and the traumatized boys and girls after war. But they are not news anymore. And that means that all their unpaid, very, very emotionally and labor-draining work after war is not tallied.
And I have noticed in the current crisis in Gaza that when we see news footage, we see lots of footage of women grieving. We see lots of footage of women crying, holding their children close, trying to escape. But we don't actually see footage of women with agency. We see footage of women as victims. And How should a feminist be thinking about that kind of portrayal of women?
It's so long term and it's so deep seated. I remember a book that I wrote about where women were in the US-Iraq war was going to press. And my wonderful editor, who you also know, Naomi Schneider at UCal Press, and I, we are very conscious of book covers and very conscious of the power of imagery. And we set about trying to find a book cover image for this book called Nimmo's War, Emma's War, about Iraqi and American women in the Iraq. And we worked really hard and we finally found a wonderful photograph by a Canadian Iraqi photographer who showed Iraqi women on an apartment house staircase having an animated conversation. Three women having this really vibrant conversation with each other in the middle of war. And we both agreed that's the image we want. But it took us weeks to find photographs that were not of women weeping. I think women weeping is the main thing that most of us imagine women do during war, but they don't. They organize. There are Gazan feminists. There are West Bank Palestinian feminists. There are Israeli Palestinian feminists. There are Israeli Jewish feminists, and all of them are in high activity right now. But they aren't portrayed, they aren't interviewed, and most of us don't try to find out where they are and what they're thinking. And I think one of the reasons why, I can't remember which lesson it is, you've got the book in front of you, but one of the other things I thought is a lesson, this is me dreaming up what's a lesson, but and that it was that feminists are active in the midst of war. They don't just go to bed or start crying or flee. They take part in, they organize, they initiate activism in the middle of war.
That's really important. And I also want to emphasize for listeners that these 12 lessons in are not at all prescriptive. What you're really doing is giving us a framework in each one to be, as you say, curious, to ask questions, to look around us, to look around the globe halfway and ask a different question than everybody else is asking. Cynthia, I want to ask you my final question, which is, why should our listeners read this book now?
I think because we have to think about war. We have to think about how to prevent it. We have to think about how to end it. We have to think about what a genuinely sustainable, justice-seeking peace would look like. And that's the job for all of us. There's not a person on this planet who isn't in some way or other complicit in war making when we don't think about the prevention of war, the rolling back of militarism, and the work it takes to build the kind of trust that's the basis for sustainable peace. We're all in this, all of us, all of us.
And that's it for today's show. Thanks for listening. You can subscribe to Why Now on your favorite podcast platform. Please leave a rating and a comment so that other listeners can find us. Go to the Political Junkie Substack at clairepotter.substack.com for show notes, to listen to more episodes, or leave a comment. You can subscribe for free, or you can support my work for as little as $5 a month and get every podcast and every newsletter delivered straight to your desktop. Share this podcast with a friend who loves history, politics, and smart conversation. And you can follow me on Threads, Blue Sky, or Instagram. Why Now is supported by the New School for Social Research and by paying subscribers to Political Junkie. Why Now and Political Junkie are written, recorded, edited, and produced by me, Claire Potter. My opening theme is by Galaxy News, and my closing theme is by Avocado Junkie. That's all for now. See you next time.